You're listening to Successful Active Investing is Hard by James O'Shaughnessy of O'Shaughnessy Asset Management, LLC.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Please welcome to the stage AAII's president, John Bukowski.
Good afternoon. Hope everybody is enjoying a wonderful lunch and a wonderful event as well. Before we get started with our afternoon keynote presentation, I have a few announcements to make. Notably, the exhibit hall will be open after our presentation today. And if you have a little bit of a taste for some sweets, we'll have a dessert table as well as light refreshments that will be served during the luncheon, after the luncheon. We want to thank, it's very important, many people put this conference on, and exhibitors are important part of the contribution, as well as sponsors. I'd like to thank Discover and TD Ameritrade as our platinum sponsors, both very well-respected companies. A bit of news here. The registration area, the booth has moved from outside the office here to inside of the exhibit hall area. So if you need to speak to someone regarding any information, please visit us at the booth inside the registration exhibit area. And one more note is the conference app. Hopefully everyone's had a chance to download the app. I know I actually went online this morning, and many of the speakers have made their presentation slides available even ahead of time. So I was able to take a sneak peek at today's presentation today and get excited about some of the information. So if you have any trouble seeing any slides, open up your app, open up your computer. You can feel free to look at the slides as you go along. As the food digests, I thought I'd give you a little bit of a quiz. I know we've had half the conferences over, and hopefully you've gotten some enlightening information. But I'm going to throw out a couple words here, and I want you to think about these words and think about what they might have in common. Adjustable rate mortgage. Done deal. Hip hop. Log out, quant, zero coupon, core inflation, food court, La La Land, outsource, and smoke and mirrors. All those words have one thing in common. They first appeared in print in the year 1979. Now, why is that interesting? It's also the first year that the journal appeared in print. And what was the market like back then? A lot of the words there were tied to inflation and interest rates. So quite interestingly, the S&P 500 was yielding 5.4% at the start of the year. Today, it's yielding about 2. 90-day T-bills, this is going to shock you, they're at 9.35%. Today, they're a little lower. What's even interesting is the 10-year Treasury note was yielding 9%, inverted yield curve. Now, what was the rate of inflation? It was also at 9% that year, and it was actually going to go higher. The S&P 500 closed yesterday above 3,000. It closed at 96.73 the year the association started publishing the journal. That's a 3,000% increase, annualized about 9%. In terms of the stock market itself, the PE was trading at about 8.3, much higher today, closer to 20. The key there is that much has changed in the market, but really our mission, our goal has not changed. We're here to provide you unbiased investment education to help take you through the field of information that comes to you, some of it good, some of it bad, arm you with the tools you need to make your own investment decisions or to work with a professional that can help you make those decisions for you. So we've devoted the last 40 years looking at all the various abilities and qualities that individual investors have. Because what's appropriate for the individual investor may not be appropriate for the institutional investor. So much of what we hear on Wall Street, on CNBC, is very short-term focused. What we try to do is look at the long-term quantitative elements that help us, give us our competitive advantage. And coming to meetings like this, it really helps us in that regard. It helps hopefully you. You know, we as individuals have the ability to control our destiny. And it's not just quant, it's the emotional ability as well. And we've devoted the last 40 years with that kind of information. We're in this camp together, and it's wonderful to bring us together in this conference and learn from each other and learn from our gifted speakers like we have today. One of our goals is really to recognize when someone has made a valuable contribution in the field of investment education. And we established the James Clunan Award for Investor Education just for that purpose. We've honored people like Jim Bogle, and today it's our pleasure to honor our keynote speaker, Jim O'Shaughnessy, with the award as well. But let me tell you a little bit about Jim before we get started. His title is the Chairman and Co-Chief Investment Officer of O'Shaughnessy Asset Management. But that's not really what he's known for, at least not to me. If you're a student of the market, which I'm sure many of you are, you've read one of his many books. Whether it's Invest Like the Best, which actually came with a software disk, a value screen software disk inside. You load it into your computer so you could do screening and mimic the strategies of the best investors, to actually to doing a deep dive in the kind of quantities that work and figuring out which ones work, which ones don't, and how you, as an investor, can take advantage of them. But his work hasn't stopped there. His work continues because he's looked, it's nice to have a good quantitative element on how one plans things, but without the emotional fortitude, we also won't succeed. It's putting it all together. Knowledge is one thing. Having the strength and discipline to follow through when times are good or bad is something else. And with that, I'd please like to welcome Jim O'Shaughnessy up to the podium.
Was very, very mean to me, and height of my good fortune, and then the dénouement.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'll put this for you.
Yeah. Okay. So great. Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is a wonderful crowd. I'm really delighted to see so many faces here because I joined AAII, I think, when I was still in my 20s, because I was looking for any kind of information that I could find on trying to make sense of the stock market. And I always start these with a little story that illustrates our dilemma. And it concerns this fellow who dies and goes up to heaven. And he sees a big group of people sitting around, and there's someone sitting in the center, and he's no different. He wanders over, and sitting at the center of the circle is Albert Einstein. And Albert Einstein says, "Hi, Albert Einstein, welcome to heaven. What's your IQ?" And the first person he points at said, "Well, you know, I guess I was kind of average. You know, my IQ was about 110. And Einstein goes, "Okay, 110. Maybe you can bring me up to speed on all the new TV shows, what's going on in politics, you know, all of those types of things." And the guy goes, "Oh, I'd be glad to do that." Points to the next fellow and he goes, "Hi, Albert Einstein, welcome to heaven. What's your IQ?" And the guy goes, "You know, I really don't want to boast, but my IQ was 170 when I was on Earth." And Einstein goes, "Oh, this is fantastic. I haven't had a 170 up here in like 100 years. This is going to be amazing. We'll be able to talk about the unified field theory, string theory, dark matter, quantum weirdness. Is the world a simulation? Oh my gosh, this is going to be great. And the guy goes, well, wait a minute. If the world's a simulation, that means heaven's a simulation too. And Einstein merely smiled. And he goes, you wait right over there because I want to talk to you right after this. And he points to the third fellow and he goes, hi, Albert Einstein, welcome to heaven. What's your IQ? Guy looks down and he goes, I'm not going to tell you. And Einstein says, come on, you're in heaven. You have nothing to worry about. You soon will be filled with infinite knowledge. Tell me what your IQ was when you were on Earth. The guy takes a deep breath and says, well, when I was on Earth, I made Forrest Gump look like a genius. My IQ was 71. And Einstein goes, so, what do you think the market's going to do tomorrow? I think we all feel like Forrest Gump when people say, what's the market going to do tomorrow? Because the truth is, no one, and I don't care who you pick out, who you think is your guru, who you think is your great prognosticator, no one knows what the market is going to do tomorrow. And we're going to get into this a little bit more when we get into the presentation. But I think one of the big reasons for this is we are short-term thinkers living in a long-term world. And we can blame evolution for this. A long-term perspective is not nice to have, not good to have. If you don't have a long-term perspective, you're simply not going to be able to make it. And the odds are so stacked against us. You know, I've been doing this for more than 30 years, and I had the good fortune of buying puts, the biggest position of puts I had ever amassed in my young life, during the crash of 1987. I was 27 years old. And of course, if any of you have 27-year-olds, you know about the old Mark Twain axiom, where Mark Twain said his son thought that he was an idiot when he was 16, but when the son turned 25, he couldn't believe at how much smarter his father had become. And so I was like any other 27-year-old. I had my little system that I was working with, and I amassed this huge position of puts. And most people don't know this, but the day before the big crash, there was a mini crash. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down about 100 points, and what happened to me is very good in keeping your mind focused on why we are our own worst enemy. What happened to me? I panicked. I was listening to these so-called experts on FNN, that shows how far back I go, before CNBC had taken over FNN, and I kid you not, literally everyone, big names, right? Really, really big names back in 1987, they all were singing the same tune. This is it. This was the crash. Because it was something like a 6 or a 7% decline. And I remember sitting there, and I had a quote machine. I felt very fancy. But one where you had to take over your home phone and put it into the cradle, making my wife, let's put it this way, a little annoyed with me. Anyway, I sold them all. All of them before one day, well, we had a weekend for me to recover, one day before the great crash of 1987. But rather than to feel bad about this, it really underlined for me the fact that I was my own worst enemy. And people don't really like to hear this, but it's a fact. And by the way, it is a universal fact. I did a piece not too long ago talking about behavioral finance, and I said, you know, if I wasn't a quantitative investor, my God, I would commit every behavioral bias in the book. So we have this situation where we can intellectually understand things, and yet ultimately intellectual understanding does not lead to emotional understanding. We are optimized for a world that no longer exists. Everyone sitting in this room, who do you descend from? You descend from the person who, when they saw the bush wiggling, ran away. Not the brave ones who went, oh, I wonder what's in that bush. I'm going to go check it out. They got eaten. So think about that for a minute. All of us, and I don't care who we are, all of us were the ones that didn't get eaten. Why didn't they get eaten? Because they were really jumpy. Thank God they didn't have caffeine, right? It would have been awful. But the fact is, as this quote, I love this quote from Shakespeare, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. So the talk today is, when I did the title, my assistant said, that's really a great way to grab everyone, talking about how hard it is to be an active investor. Well, one of the things that makes me say that is I have literally spent my life looking for research to build on and build on a lot of behavioral stuff, a lot of market stuff, et cetera. And one of the things that I found really discouraged me. First off, we have a quote from Danny Kahneman, who basically says, you can know about all this stuff. We can drill this stuff into you forever and ever and ever. And you know what? Our different ways of thinking, our system one and our system two, are not fully engaged. So, right, when you go in for a risk tolerance questionnaire, are you nervous? Are you angry? Are you anxious? No. You're generally going in feeling pretty good. And so when you take that risk questionnaire, you're going to answer questions. And by the way, you are going to answer the questions honestly at that time, devoid of all emotional input. So, my good friend Jason Zweig at the Wall Street Journal wrote an interesting column saying, risk questionnaires are like asking people if they're afraid of snakes. The only way to really get the right answer is to throw a snake in their lap. Then we're going to get to the gist of the situation, because evolution has made us, over eons, terrified of snakes and spiders, a whole bunch of other things. I have a friend who quipped, well, I don't know, 50,000 years from now, are human beings going to be afraid of cars? They're going to see a car and think, oh my God, this is awful. But the fact is, we are not optimized to keep up with what technology, with what society, with what all of that is going way beyond us. And for people who think, well, that's just, you know, those are theories. No, they're not. We have seen this over my 30 years every single year. And it always happens. I mean, one of the things that I always say is the last sustainable edge is arbitraging human nature. Why? Because human nature doesn't change, right? Markets change minute by minute. Human nature changes millennial by millennial, if at all. So One of the things that we want to be able to talk about today is, what are our challenges? How do we really need to go ahead with this? So this is a rather dour quote from Danny, who, by the way, himself is very, very pessimistic. I love that. You know, he spent all of this time in behavioral biases, and when you talk to him, which I had the good fortune to do, I was kind of like, at the end of the conversation, I was trying to cheer him up. I'm like, Danny, honestly, it can't be this bad. And he goes, oh, Jim, it's worse. It's worse. And I'm like, but Danny, I've read all of your work. I've read all of the behavioral stuff. And he goes, and you are still going to commit every single foible. And I went, no, I'm a quant. I remove myself from my emotional ability to override. And he goes, well, then you're one of the lucky ones. Because quant isn't the only way to do it, by the way. I have a friend in Vienna who trades a traditional book. He's a trader, which I think, you know, when I was with him in New York, I said, so you're a member of the 1.5% of traders who actually make money at it? And one of his little tricks is, when something is going against him, he literally removes himself from the situation and goes for a walk in the park, calls his mother, does something completely divorced from the market and the here and now. And that's worked very well for him. So make no mistake, I'm not saying that you have to do it my way. You don't. That's one of my central messages, which we'll get to in a minute here. But then I found this next study, which was really depressing. And this study was essentially one that was done by two researchers in Europe, in Sweden, where they keep records of literally everything, from, you know, when you were born to what your stock portfolio looks like. And so to these researchers, this was a huge treasure trove. And what they wanted to key in on was identical twins. And when they did that, what they found was the basis of their study boils down to this. We find that a long list of investment biases, and I won't go through them all, are because of genetic factors. In fact, they estimate around 45% of the way you choose to invest is because of genetic factors. And here's the part of it that really scares me. Genetic factors that cannot be educated against. That's a bummer. So we are existing in this world where, you know, a passive investor has one point of failure, really. And that one point of failure is they panic when the market goes against them and they sell near the bottom and they destroy all of their compounding effect, right? Active investors have two points of failure. The first is the same as the passive guy, that the active investor freaks out, sells all of his positions, and runs for the hills. But the second one is, if they aren't performing better than their benchmark, they oftentimes will throw the towel in. And this is especially pernicious because it can happen even when markets are doing really, really well, right? So let's say we have a market where the S&P 500 is up 15% per year for the last 3 years, and our active investor is up 13%, and he or she will say, this strategy just doesn't work anymore. I'm going to abandon it. Well, of course, you can see this coming a mile away. When they do the research, the managers that they fire go on to do much better than the managers they hire. Reversion to the mean. You know, there's a lot of very simple concepts, and yet what I have found in my career is we are very good at intellectually understanding things, and we are very poor at dealing with the emotional way we react to things. Therein lay our biggest problem. Our emotions are, by their very nature, rather short-term. And if we go back to our ancestors who fled that bush that was moving around, what are we programmed to do? We're programmed to run away. And that takes, it's very easy to run away in a market, right? The market is going against you. All of the emotions are dumping. You have the cortisol effect. And literally, those emotions take you over. I've witnessed it time and time and time again. During the financial crisis, I went down to see a client who had been with us for something like 15 years. And literally, as I was walking into his office, he did this. He gave me the Heisman. He's like, O'Shaughnessy, I know you're going to have 15 charts about why I should be investing right now, and I don't care. He had taken his program, which his process, which was really well thought out, and completely blew it up because he simply could not handle the emotional up and down that both he and his clients were undergoing. So, what do we need? What do we need to really, if we're going to be an active investor in any manner, right? What do we have to have? That's what we're going to talk about now. So I passionately believe that for an active investor to succeed, they must value process over outcome. Again, what's natural is the inversion of that. As much as we say we don't pay attention to performance, as much as we say that, no, we don't chase the high performers, all of us do. Everybody does. It's part of the emotional way that we try to make sense of doing things. In fact, the SEC had to do a regulation requiring managers to say past performance is not indicative of future results. But again, it's so alien to the rest of the way we live our lives. Let's say you're going to a doctor, right? What's the first thing you're going to ask? What is his or her success rate? How often does the surgery that they perform work out? And we're going to seek out the doctors that have the best reputation, that have the best track record. And it goes across any profession. Plumbers? Well, I don't want a plumber who doesn't know how to do his work. Obviously, I want a plumber that is really good. And on and on and on. So the market is very, very different in that it's the one place where just following the performance leads you down many blind alleyways. If we take a look at this chart, this is a 5-year result of investing in the 50 stocks from our universe of the total stock market that had the highest 1-year gain in sales. Boy, sounds intuitive, sounds like it should work, makes a lot of economic sense, right? These people are really doing well with their sales. And then we're sitting looking at this chart. We're going to be pretty compelled. We're going to be pretty compelled to give this manager a lot of money. Because this manager not only is going to be seeking money from us, he's also going to be on financial TV, he's got a popular blog, he makes so much sense, right? And that's another aspect that really bedevils us. We prefer narrative to statistics, right? Stalin chillingly said, one death is a tragedy, 1 million is a statistic. If you think about that for a minute, that's very, very chilling, but he's right. So we focus on the one. Again, it's our very human nature to do that. And I must admit that if I was looking at this manager and he was or she was giving the song and dance about why this is going to work forever and why this is the best way to do things, I probably would have given the guy money. Because all I was looking at was that he had nearly tripled over those 5 years the results of the S&P 500. That's almost impossible to do. Instead of looking at those numbers, what we need to do is ask a different question. The question we need to ask is, what's your process? How do you get to the stocks that you buy? How do you decide which stock you're going to sell? How long will you wait? There's a whole list of questions, and I think AAII might have actually done something like this a few years back about the right questions to ask when you're hiring somebody, which is another great reason to belong to AAII. And yet, we don't. We are absolutely dazzled. I watched the live-action Aladdin with my grandson, who is 5, the other day. And it all seems that we're all taken in by that staff that hypnotizes. That's what those numbers do. But if you are a person who values process over outcome, what do you realize? You realize that a good process can lead to a bad outcome, but the other is true as well. A very bad process can lead, just by luck, to a very good outcome. That's why we need the fullness of time to say, okay, does this process make sense, buying the stocks with the highest annual sales gain? Well, when we extend our time horizon a little bit, here's what we find. That particular strategy compounded less than T-bills over a very long period of time, 1964 to 2009. We're using a lot from my book. We're updating it. Don't worry. You'll get it through 2019. But actually, the results are still pretty miserable. And if we inflation adjusted that, you were wiped out. So if you don't look at the underlying process, and by the way, if you do it yourself, write out your process. Ask yourself hard questions. Say, does this really make sense? Then study. Because another thing that I really pound the table about is my investment strategy might not be right for you, nor for you, nor for you. We have to come, if we want to succeed as active investors, we have to come to a situation where we have designed a strategy, even if we're working with an advisor, we have devised a strategy that's right for us. Because if it's not right for you, you simply will abandon it at the absolute worst time to do so. So process over outcome. Not intuitive. People don't talk like this. If you watch all of the league tables, what does everyone publish? Here are the 20 best performing ETFs or mutual funds or what have you. And it's seared into our brain. And it's very difficult to invert that type of thinking. So if you take away nothing else, simply the idea of valuing process over outcome will put you ahead of about 90% of the various investors that you're competing against. Now, long-term data is essential. People often ask me, well, what does it matter? What does it matter what something did in 1933? 1933, they didn't have computers, they didn't have anything. And my response is always the same. But they did have human beings. And as long as human beings price securities, what you want to see is the long span of time. Because human behavior, unlike stock market behavior, is very predictable. I often joke that the four horsemen of the investment apocalypse are fear, greed, hope, and ignorance. And if you think about that, only ignorance is not an emotion. Fear, greed, and hope have wiped out more portfolio value than any bear market, including the great financial crisis, because it drives people to be buying when they should be selling and selling when they should be buying. And this is something we go back and back and back all the way to the South Sea trading bubble, which Isaac Newton lost a fortune in. And it was wonderful because this is one of my exceptions. So they wrote poems about the South Sea Trading Company. One went, "Fill the South Sea goblet full, the gods shall of our stock take care. Europa pleased accepts the bull, and Jove with joy puts off the bear. Hint, if anybody writes a poem about a stock you own, sell it. Because poetry is emotion writ large. But as we go and keep going forward, until we get to 1900, and there's this newfangled thing called an automobile, and guess what? In the first decade of the 20th century, there were more than 200 automakers. Sound familiar? Remember the internet rush? Pets.com, you know, NewYorkCity.com sold for like $10 million. Absolute insanity. But when you look at the fullness of time, you see a much different picture emerge. Now, what you're looking at here is our value composite. By the way, we don't use a single factor in any of our models. We found, and again, I wrote a piece that said mistakes were made, and yes, by me. And in the original version of the book, a fellow had me sign the original version earlier, and I said, you know, I don't think I have an original version left, so kudos. But this is unequivocal in showing you what the results over long periods of time. And what's important to me is what's at the bottom, the base rates, the batting averages. What you want to do is put the probabilities on your side. We'll get to that in a minute. But you want really great probabilities that you're going to succeed. And look, the cheapest 10% on all rolling 10-year periods outperform 90+% 99% of the time. The most expensive, 3% of the time. And again, if we take this out of the stock market and just said, okay, let's put it in regular business, right? So there's a food truck over here, and I want to buy it, so I approach the owner and I say, how much for the food truck? And he goes, I don't really think I want to sell it. And I said, well, can I at least ask, you know, what your annual revenues are? And he says, sure, annual revenues are $100,000. And I went, pretty good, pretty interesting. If you were to name a price, what would it be? And he comes right back to me and says, $10 million. I'm going to look at him like, did you get treatment today? Because you might have missed your meds that time around. What's so funny is that in our everyday life, we are very rational about these types of things. If someone outside of the stock market is trying to sell you whatever it happens to be, and they name some ridiculous price, you'll say, you're crazy, and walk away. Get a great narrative and a great story and everybody on financial TV talking about what a great opportunity this is, and it seems to freeze the prefrontal cortex and the reptilian brain takes over, right? Ooh, greed, I can get that. So if you have access to long-term data, which is available in my and many, many other people's books, so I'm not here to sell my book. There's literally libraries of great research, and I think AAII has actually done some lists of some of the best books. So again, a great resource for you. So long-term data, essential. We won't spend much time here. This is simply why we went to composites, because guess what? Factors come in and out of favor. And what I really love about this slide is when you look at this slide, when do you think all of the academic papers talking about how great a factor is start to appear? Right near that top, right before the factor goes into not doing so well. So we have so many things competing, and it's very difficult if we're trying to live just a regular life to try to keep up with all this. But this is why we moved to factor composites. This is more for your information. I just thought you might be interested in the factors that we do in fact look at. I know that you guys have a computer program that can find a lot of these for your members, and that's up on our website as well, so we have that as well. The next thing is simplicity is preferred to complexity. What do I mean by that? I mean that we tend to get really excited by the man or the woman who just sounds so brilliant. They have such a great story. It's so compelling. It's so complicated. And we did a study that looked at simple versus complex, and guess what? Everybody naturally prefers the complex, even though the simple has far more signal to it than the complex. This is an example of that. We use something called shareholder yield, which is the dividend yield and buyback. This, by the way, is what all the people online and the journal and everything are getting their hair, setting their hair on fire about. And for I think the last year, these buybacks accounted for 0.67% of all trading volume. It's another interesting thing, and I wish I had more time because I would get into it, but social contagion is real. And I've been doing a lot of studying on mimetic behavior, which means simply we learn and do things by copying other people. This happens everywhere in the animal kingdom. We are not any different. And so for whatever reason, social contagion decided that it hated this idea of, you know, the horror, returning money to the actual stock owners. Seems crazy. But when you have the data, you see, boy, oh boy, does this work very well. This is the slide that really fascinates me, because when I'm having lunch or having a conversation with a fellow, by the way, I love to talk about with people who disagree with me. I do, because I might be missing something. And so curiosity is really, really good. Dorothy Parker had a great line, which is, curiosity is the cure for boredom. There is no cure for curiosity. And as long as you are curious and wanting to see what's what and trying to figure things out, this is the slide, though, that when he saw it, he was just like, this just can't be true. And this slide is a little old. The newer slide actually shows even higher returns to the buybacks. Diluters, boy, they strip about 4% from your returns as their investors. And why? Well, of course, it makes sense. If you're issuing shares, your shares are worth less, and it's just kind of math. Debt issuers, now not sensible debt, big debt. If you see big debt, generally speaking, going forward, that is a very, very bad signal for return to that particular company. Expansion, the egotistical CEO is like a cartoon character these days, right? They did a study that I actually loved, which was what really drives whether a company is going to take over another company? Two things. Number one, the CEO's ego. Number two, proximity of that company to the CEO's residence. And I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that's very scientific. I can definitely see why they'd want to do that. Well, the truth is in the numbers. It's the worst. It subtracts 4.5% from you, the owner's, returns. Bad behavior begets bad returns, and they are to be avoided. Acquisition, sort of the same thing. Then finally, reducing debt adds a little. Buybacks add a lot. And when you think about it, devoid of all of the political and other reasons people might be against this, it just makes a lot of sense. If a company hasn't, they have a hurdle rate for new projects. They have a hurdle rate for all of the things they might be engaging in. And if they can't have projects that meet that hurdle rate, the best single thing they can do is buy back shares. That's good for you as the owner. That's good for everyone involved. And yet, I find it, you know, kind of fascinating that people can rally against this so much. Well, the next thing you need to be a successful active investor is you need to use strategies that are very consistent. There's a lot of strategies. So, for example, right now, there's all the hullabaloo about, you know, pot stocks and CBD and all these types of things. And so we're not buying them simply because we don't have a history that would demonstrate to us that that particular category does well. With shareholder yield, this is the result. This is rolling five-year returns all the way back to the early 1960s. Those are good odds. Which sort of leads me, we'll skip that, to the next problem that we have, and we have this problem because we're human beings. Successful, yeah, you're reading it, right? Successful active investors ignore forecasts and projections. This is the one that hits us right at the heart. Whoops, sorry. That hits us right at the heart of our emotions because we crave narrative. We crave narrative because we are deterministic thinkers. I always say we are deterministic thinkers living in a probabilistic world, and those two don't go very well together. The power of a story is so much more compelling than numbers that even I, when I'm listening to a great story, you know, I've always trained myself to say, well, is there any data supporting this? And I will tell you 60% of the time the answer is no. But the reason we pay so much attention to projections and forecasts is it feeds our illusion of control. The illusion of control is another one of evolution's little bad boys knocking around in our head. Because what it does is, if it didn't work and you didn't have the illusion of control, you would probably be committed. Because if we don't have the illusion that we ourselves control the events that we're engaging in, that's a very, very bad place to be. And thus, we over-rely on things like forecasts, predictions, storytelling. Yeah, you know, I will come often to conferences and sit in the back when other people are speaking, and it just never ceases to amaze me. One guy, I was texting my son, I'm like, I know that this doesn't work, but I think we should probably give him some money because he sounds so good. We are all susceptible. I did an interview once and they went, well, so surely, Jim, you know, you aren't susceptible to all these behavioral biases. And I looked at him and I said, if I was not a quant, I would be more susceptible to these behavioral biases. Let's not kid ourselves. We're all human beings and we all crave narratives. It's just the way we're designed. And again, if we go back and study evolution, take a child, we come out with the software fully formed. And if you take a child, let's say I have a child, and then I give that child to a Mandarin-speaking couple, guess what? 3 years from then, that child is going to be speaking fluent Mandarin because it's in the hardware. Reading, different question. Why does it take so long for us to teach our kids to read? Didn't make it into the most updated version that is in our mind. So we love these particular stories, and we can't get away from them. You know, Buffett, I always like to use him as an example because we're back to the, well, Warren Buffett used to be the greatest investor of all time, and he's not anymore, and he's got some of his longtime people leaving him. And we were able to essentially quant Mr. Buffett's methodology. And what we found was that over long periods of time, boy, does it work and work well. So why does it work well for Mr. Buffett and Charlie Munger? It works well because successful active investors are patient and persistent. If you lack patience, don't invest money in the stock market. If you are not persistent in your ability to see your ideas through to the end, don't do it. Put your money in an index fund because it will take you down. And I can't tell you the number of people who, super smart people that I come into contact with all the time, and they just keep telling me, but Jim, this story is so compelling. This is just fantastic. I've got to go with it. And what's ultimately happened is that I've recommended that they move to index funds. This is fun. The CXO advisory tracks all of the predictions. And that's the other funny thing, right? It's kind of like, wait a minute, people are making all of these very specific predictions. Why aren't we tracking them to see if they're right or not? Well, CXO Advisory Group does. Of the 68 people that they tracked between 1998 and 2012, the average 47% of the sample did not beat flipping a coin. 48% of the gurus had accuracy below 50%. Now let that sink in. You know, I'm often asked, well, Jim, what do you think is going to happen in the market? Well, is the market expensive? And those are often the questions that I get. And as I joke with people, probably of all professional money managers, I say, I don't know, probably more often than any other professional, because I don't. The future is unknowable. Now, the longer future and the longer the time you look at becomes more and more knowable. In the short term, it's all noise. In the long term, it's mostly signal. And that's yet another thing that to be successful as an investor in active management, you need. This is one of my favorites. Successful active investors think in terms of probabilities, not possibilities. Think about it. If we all thought in terms of possibilities, no one would be in this ballroom right now. We would probably be cowering under our bed sheets in our hotel rooms because of all the possibilities that could happen. A plane could crash into the hotel. I could get up and slip in the shower. I could choke when I was trying to brush my teeth. All possible. However, the possibility is tiny. What we want to do is think in terms of probabilities. And that's when you want to look at the long-term data. Now, this is very hard to read, so I'll simply tell you what it is. I wrote a piece in 2009 in March called A Generational Buying Opportunity. And I have only written, I think, two forecasting style pieces, and they all came from simply the numbers. My own opinion was not part of the dissertation. And so I said, as we were nearing the lows during the financial crisis, I said, let's take a look at the 50 worst 10-year real results, in other words, inflation stripped away, and see what happens. Well, what happens is that when you get to 3, 5, 7, and 10 years, after that 10-year worst performance, there are no negative numbers. So getting used to things like that is very, very helpful. Now, these are some slides that literally I included because I wanted you to have some access to the way we look at the market, because I want to close on the final thing that we need to be good active investors, and that is good active investors have strong mental attitudes. This is a hard one. I have studied the Stoics, I have studied Taoism, I have studied a variety of philosophies that helped me get here. But the fact is, this is hard, and I'm not going to soft soap it for you. It is very hard to be able to maintain a position when everyone in your family is telling you what an idiot you are. And by the way, I've been called an idiot by everyone in my family multiple times. Sometimes they're right. But one of the things that we're fighting against is the five fears that we all share. This is really interesting. This is from a Psychology Today article from 2012. And the list is kind of scary in and of itself. The first thing we fear is extinction, me too, mutilation, loss of autonomy, separation, and ego death. Okay, so I think those last three are the ones that really do us in. Loss of autonomy. If we believe that we're going left and the rest of the world is going right, what are all those folks going right going to think about us? They're going to think very unkind things about us. They're going to think that O'Shaughnessy is a mad Irishman who's been out in the sun for too long. And we have to be willing to say, okay, thank you for your opinion. Now move on the wrong way. Separation, you know, I've read a lot about this, and fear of abandonment, of being separated from loved ones, from colleagues who we share a good deal of our working life with, it's a biggie. It makes the top five. And again, if you're holding one opinion and the world is holding another, you're in trouble. You know, Shakespeare famously said, there is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And if you can grasp that, and if you can really get the fact that that makes a big difference, it's going to be very helpful. And the final one, ego death. So I've been doing a lot of reading in philosophy. This is a big one. This is a very big one. The writer Ryan Holiday actually has a book called Ego is the Enemy. And I cannot tell you over my career how profoundly true that is. I have argued with endless people, and they are so wed to their position about why a particular stock or industry or market trend is going to continue that they've made it part of their personality. And the advice that I would give to you is to realize it is not part of your personality. It's simply an opinion, and opinions can change. So, to sum up, and then we'll take some questions. If you're going to be an active investor, you've got to be able to know about and conquer all of these things we've been talking about today. And I will be honest with you, it's not easy. However, you have, in my opinion, one of the greatest advantages of anyone who's doing investing. You are individuals. You can buy stocks that I could never touch because the amount that you're buying is so much smaller. I urge you to take a look at the microcap universe. Lots of dogs, but lots of diamonds in the rough. You, not having to give a quarterly report, can live with it. Professional managers are judged quarterly, and so therefore try as best they can to make it look good. You've all heard of window dressing. But as individuals guided by the principles that you're reading about in AAII, I think that the advantages that you hold over me are significant and sustainable. So with that, I will say thank you and open it up to any questions anyone might have. Thank you. Questions? Generally speaking, I find that it's much better for me to speak after lunch because when I do it before lunch, everyone just leaves. The worst slot, by the way, for anyone speaking is at the end of the day, where you are the only thing keeping them away from the bar. I've simply said, if they offer me that slot, nope, not taking it. I have a question here.
Excited to hear you speak. I have all your books. And I'm curious, in your most recent edition, which will be coming out of What Works on Wall Street, there was a system of investing in the top 25 highest paying utilities and the top 25 highest paying consumer staples. Mm-hmm. Has that continued to outperform? And do you still recommend that?
Thank you for the question. It's about utilities and consumer staples because we found historically they had the lowest volatility over the entire test period. The rise of the growth at any cost has cost those strategies a little bit, but from a long-term perspective, it has continued. They continue to do quite well. And if you think about it, it makes some sense. Consumer staples, we all have to shave, we all have to brush our teeth, we all need toilet paper. And so those industries tend to be the least hard hit when markets turn down. I haven't looked at the exact numbers between 09 and 19. I did glance at something a year or so ago. They were not doing as well as they were in the 09, but they hadn't turned around and gone backwards, let's put it that way. So for a very conservative strategy, still think that that's an excellent way to look at your investments. She's pointing, but I don't see.
I think we have a question over here.
Okay, great.
You just said the micro cap area was someplace to really look at.
Yeah.
What is your recommendation for a process to look at that area?
Great question. So on our website, which is www.osam.com, you will find, I think, four papers that addresses your very question. What to look for. If AAII hands out these slides, there is a specific slide that I have included, again, just for your benefit. And, they've taken power away from me. I can't advance it. That's one way to get a guy off the stage. Pretty soon my mic's gonna go. I have my voice carries, so I... Yeah, unfortunately, I can't advance it. Now I can. There are specific things you want to look at. Multi-factor composites increase efficacy. We include microcaps here. Value works much better in microcap land. Momentum works much better. Financial strength works much better. Only earnings quality doesn't do too much in microcap land. So we think that the reason for this is, quite frankly, because they are simply overlooked. We have a microcap strategy, which is one of my favorites. All of our family invests in it. When it gets to about $200 million, we'll close it to outside investors. I was glancing the other day at the number of companies that we own that got taken over. And let's say over a 3 or 4 year period, of the 110 stocks that, and they're different 110 stocks, but of that grouping over that annual periods, those several annual periods, more than 75 of the companies were taken over. So the other thing is, this is where private equity is hunting right now. And they don't have any analysts. So quite simply, it is a treasure trove of very scarce information. And as individual investors, you can do very well with it. Now, let me put a disclaimer on that. It is extremely volatile. And if you are one who cannot see big ups and downs on any given day, then you might want to rethink whether you're going to make investments in microcap. But if you are the type of person who can just say, this is a 10-year commitment, it's almost its own asset class. It just destroys everything in large cap and mid cap and even small cap land. Questions? I see one back here.
The late John Bogle was skeptical regarding factor investing, thinking it would not have predictive value. I wonder, in your mind, how do you differentiate between data mining and something that's an investable, workable ratio or factor?
That is a great question, and one I have spent a long time trying to do the right thing. As an aside, John Bogle's son runs a hedge fund based on factors, which I think is kind of funny. That John, showing he was a good dad, invested in, even though he didn't believe in it. So, data mining is riff in quantitative analysis today. And it is riff because of the plethora of new tools made available to people to run these back tests. We take, if the spectrum is very conservative over here and very aggressive over here, we're over here. For us, something has to make traditional economic sense before we would ever embrace it. We also spend a lot of time using out-of-sample periods. In fact, we're in the process of building a data set from using the Moody's manuals that will give us an out-of-sample 1927 through 1964 ability to run these tests. We have run some already, and not a surprise, the out-of-sample performed exactly as the in-sample. We also tested on non-U.S. markets, so that you should have the same directionality that you get in U.S. markets. Now, there's going to be a plethora of reasons why things are going to differ. But what we're really looking at is direction. And then the final thing that I will say about factor investing is, you know, you read so many papers about this factor is better than this factor. The academics, there are 300 factors. No, there's not. There's five. And they're trying to publish and not perish, and I get why they're doing what they're doing. But the fact is that all factor investing helps you understand is what kind of environment is the market in right now. And you can draw great inference from that. So for example, going into the .com, the factors told the story months and months and months before the actual collapse. So knowing that and using that as your guide and being conservative, testing on out of sample, and then finally, and I try to avoid being a geek when I'm answering these questions, we do something called bootstrapping, which is we randomize the data and then run it on all the randomized data sets from within the universe that we're looking at. What you should find, if you've done good research, is that they all show the same directionality. They don't, one isn't, you know, down 10% per year, while another is up 12% per year. And then finally, we look at seasonality, which is a thing. I've been teased very often for, you know, now I actually am 59, but when I was in my 30s, people would say to me, you know, you're an old fuddy-duddy for somebody who's so young. So this has been something that I have paid attention to for a long time, and like anything, it can be misused, and there's a pretty good way to see how it's being misused. If you see a model that has 13 separate factors and or a switchover between factors under certain circumstances, that's a Rube Goldberg machine. And they fit the data to, or the strategy to the data. Avoid it.
One more question.
One more question.
So I'm interested in your view on decision-making models by individuals and steps and pathways that you have seen to be very helpful to investors to move from being very emotional in decision-making to be more quantitative, non-emotional.
So that is one of the hardest questions to answer in a short period of time. I'm already a minute and 7 seconds over my time. And my answer is going to sound a little strange to you. I would recommend reading Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor who was also a very famous Stoic, Epicurus, Seneca, and Lao Tzu, who was the proponent of Taoism. The reason I make that recommendation is one of the central messages that they hold is that anything that is outside of your control should be ignored. And the markets are outside of your control. And there's so much that is outside of your control that on your third reading of Aurelius, you start to say, aha. A more contemporary person, Napoleon Hill, said, the only thing that you truly control is your mind. And if you think about that, you control how you're going to react to some bit of good or bad news, right? And then finally, instilling in yourself that great passage that the king asked all of his wise men to write what they thought would be the most profoundly true thing that would persist forever. And the line that they came up with that one was, this too shall pass. And if you start thinking that way, you stop seeing yourself in the hurly-burly of the here and now, and you essentially unstick yourself from the present, and the past, present, and future make up your now. And it's, I'm not gonna lie to you, it's difficult. But the reading is very pleasant. Marcus Aurelius was a very good thinker and a great writer, as was Seneca. And Lao Tzu is marvelous as well. And then constant repetition. And it's hard. It's very hard. And I guess the last thing that I would say is become aware of when you are emotional. We all know it, right? It's like the mind-body connection fascinates me, and it's something I'm reading about right now. But the mind can take over, and you don't even know it. Think of blushing, right? Do we will ourselves to blush? No. That's a psychological process that happens, and even if we don't want it to happen, it happens. So there's a lot going on, and that could be another couple hours. In fact, I'm writing something about that and how it can be helpful. But also remain constantly aware. I don't care if you tack it up on your computer screen or you read it every morning or whatever. Be aware that if you focus on only those things you can control, your life becomes far better, far easier, and the emotions still come. Nothing's going to stop them from doing that. But you now have a much better way to process them and get over them. Thank you very, very, very much. Well, how did that, whoop.